Drive Time on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Zurich. For pensions, protection, savings and investments. At Zurich, we deal in peace of mind.
Now, a warning that this next report contains some details that some listeners and younger ears may find distressing. Six police officers who served in Oma on the day of the bombing in August 1998 have described how the horrors of what they witnessed that day have continued to affect their lives. Several of them said the sights, sounds and smells of the aftermath have resulted in post-traumatic stress disorder, nightmares and flashbacks. They were giving evidence at the inquiry into the atrocity set up by the British government to examine whether it could have been prevented. Our reporter Una Kelly was there. So Una, tell us who the inquiry heard from today, please.
We just heard evidence from Philip Marshall. He was an RUC duty sergeant in Oma that day and effectively became the main officer directing the response on the ground in the aftermath. He said the bomb warning given to police gave no details of the make, model, colour, registration number of the car or what shop it was near. They understood it was near the courthouse and had evacuated that area. The bomb exploded further down the street where people who had been evacuated had congregated. Philip said as a person, he then had to switch off, remember that he was in charge and he had to deal with it. He said he had no option but to shut down emotionally. He said, I wanted to run, but I had to do my job. He added that the screams of people trapped under the burning car engine are one of his nightmares. He said when it came to the officers he was commanding that day, it's only when he looks back he realises how young and inexperienced they were. One was barely 19 years old. He said they were just kids.
For all of them, it was their first time at any major incident. They were just ordinary young men with mums and dads and brothers and sisters who I was demanding they carry out extraordinary tasks, seeing to the injured, applying anything to soak up blood. Helping those who could walk get down to the junction. Carrying those who couldn't walk. Getting them on board transport to hospital. And then running back up to help the next casualty. Later on, they helped me wrap and carry the dead to the alleyway. Remaining with their allocated bodies. Never complaining about what they're being asked to do by me. I got them to search extremely unsafe buildings for any possible survivors. Hours later, they went with their deceased to the temporary mortuary. New horror, more horrendous sights and smells for them to deal with. Total and utter shock of what was laid out in front of them. I had then, and to this day, have an immense pride in them all. Many still suffering today with PTSD and badly needing help.
Philip Marshall also gave details of how they tried to help the injured and move them to hospital and then the body recovery phase. A decision was made to move the dead to an alleyway off Market Street away from the lenses of the gathering media before moving them on to the temporary mortuary. The officers involved in this process who gave evidence today all said it was a horrendously difficult experience, but they felt that it was important to give as much dignity to the dead as possible, and they described how they moved them as gently as they could. Philip Marshall said he has suffered with post-traumatic stress disorder over the years. He said he felt the normal response he got at the time was man up and take a stiff drink to forget. He said that the right level of professional help for traumatised people was not available. We also heard from Richard Scott at the inquiry today. He was also an officer on duty that day and part of the team that helped to move the dead. He also suffers from PTSD and said many officers have used alcohol to deal with their experiences. He described what happened when he finally got home that night.
I don't know what time I got home, but it was late on, and whenever I did get home, I stood at my back door and stood beside the wheelie bin, and I took off every piece of clothing that I was wearing and put every piece of clothing into the bin. I just felt dirty, and my clothes had blood on them and a vile, vile smell. And I thought by taking off my clothes that would disassociate myself with the scene.
Still dealing with what they saw and witnessed and encountered in Omagh, Richard Scott there. Another officer, Una, said he tried to compartmentalise what he saw.
Yes, this was Norman Hazlitt, a young constable who was there that day. He said the terror and the horror were indelibly etched on his soul. He said he has placed the memories, the pain and the suffering, the sounds and the smells and the images from that day into a box in my mind marked Omagh. And over time, I have learned to discipline myself not to open the box, save for one single day every year, the anniversary of the bombing. Norman was also part of the team that was tasked with moving bodies from the scene to the alley and then to the morgue. When there, he was tasked with checking some of the bodies for any identifying marks. One of them was 12-year-old Spanish student Fernando Blasco Balsega, who he found with just one possession on him, a red Swiss Army knife. Norman said for him as a first responder, Fernando and his Swiss Army knife were the embodiment of innocence that was lost as a result of the bombing.
Fernando's death, more than anything else that I witnessed that day, has had the most profound and lasting effect on me. I honestly think it was the penknife that did it. He was just a wee innocent boy in his holidays with his penknife in his pocket, and he was murdered for a political cause by people of insignificance whose humanity was indifferent to the consequences of their actions. Maybe it's because when I was a wee boy, I too supported a football team and had a Swiss Army knife, but for years after the bomb, I couldn't even look at a Swiss Army knife without the tragedy of what happened to Fernando overwhelming me. After a lot of counselling and soul searching, I can now deal with it, but it hasn't been an easy process for me.
Norman Hazlitt wrote a letter to Fernando's parents to let them know that Fernando had not been left alone. He said that the gracious response from the parents left him humbled and broken. And we also heard in the inquiry today a statement from Julian Elliott, a police officer who had been tasked with liaising with families at the leisure centre who were seeking information about their loved ones. He said he tried to give them any information that he could, but that he had to take off what he called his uniform head and put on his human head. He thought that he would want to know any information if he were in that position, and he told them unofficially that their loved ones were dead. He described the reactions that he had from families. His statement was read by counsel to the inquiry, John Rafferty.
Some hugged me, some beat my chest, some hyperventilated and collapsed on the floor. It was a mixture of responses, as you can imagine, from humanity. This went on all night, relaying death messages and trying to be as kind with my words and gentle as I could.
Julian Elliott there, and he said that this affected him greatly and that he saw the people he had to break the news to in his sleep for a long time afterwards.
Una Kelly at the Omagh Inquiry, thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time this evening. Back shortly.